Soon as I heard, I wired in those favors, said to replace anything them bastards asked for with some of our own. Best of the best, and don't let them be wiser. You did what? Knox asked.
Walker dipped his head over and over, feeling good to let out the truth.
They've been making those suits to fail. Not 'cause it ain't bad out there, that's not what I figure, but they don't want your body wandering out of sight. No, sir.
He stirred his oats.
They want us all right here where they can see us.
So she's okay? Shirley asked. Walker frowned and slowly shook his head.
I told you guys, someone said. She'd run out of air by now.
She was dead anyway, someone else countered, and the argument began to build again.
This just proves they're full of shit.
Walker had to agree with that.
Everybody, hey! Let's stay calm,
Knox roared. But he appeared the least calm of them all. More workers filed in now that the moment of silence appeared to be over. They gathered around the table, faces full of worry.
This is it,
Walker said to himself, seeing what was happening, what he had started. He watched his friends and co-workers get all riled up, barking at the empty air for answers, their passions stirred.
This is it,
he said again, and he could feel it brewing, ready to burst out.
This is it, this is it.
Courtney, still hovering over him, tended to him like he was an invalid, held his wrist with those delicate hands of hers.
What is it?
She asked. She waved down the others so she could hear. She leaned close to Walker.
Walk, tell me, what is it? What is this? What are you trying to say?
This is how it starts,
he whispered. The room quiet once more. He looked up at all the faces, scanned them, seeing in their fury, in all the exploded taboos, that he was right to worry.
This is how the uprising begins.
7. Sharp misery had worn him to the bones, and about his shelves, a beggarly account of empty boxes. Lucas arrived at 34, breathless and clutching the small box, more exhausted from the laws he had broken than his habitual climb to work. He could still taste the metallic tang of adrenaline in his mouth from hiding behind the servers and rummaging through Juliet's things. He patted his chest, feeling the items there, and also his racing heart. Once he was better composed, he reached for the doors to IT and nearly cracked a knuckle as they flew outward toward him. Sammy, a tech he knew, burst out in a hurry and stormed past. Lucas called his name, but the older tech was already gone, storming up the stairs and out of sight. There was more commotion in the entrance hall, voices yelling over one another. Lucas entered warily, wondering what the fuss was about. He held open the door with his elbow and slid into the room, the box tight against his chest. Most of the yelling, it seemed, was coming from Bernard. The head of IT stood outside the security gates and barked at one tech after the other. Nearby, Sims, the head of IT security, similarly lit into three men in gray coveralls. Lucas remained frozen by the door, intimidated by the angry duo. When Bernard spotted him there, he snapped shut and waded through the trembling techs to greet him. Lucas opened his mouth to say something, but his boss was fixated less on him and more on what was in his hands.
"This is it?"
Bernard asked, snatching the box from him.
"It?"
"Everything that greaser owned fits in this little damn box?"
Bernard tugged the flaps open.
"Is this everything?"
That's what I was given, Lucas stammered. Marsh said...
Yeah, the deputy wired about his cramps. I swear the pack should stipulate an age limit for their kind. Sims!
Bernard turned to his security chief.
Conference room, now.
Lucas pointed toward the security gate and the server room beyond. I suppose I should get to...
Come with me,
Bernard said, wrapping his arm around Lucas's back and squeezing his shoulder.
I want you in on this. There seem to be fewer and fewer rat shit techs I can trust around here.
Unless you want me on the servers. We had that thing with Tower 13.
That can wait. This is more important.
Bernard ushered him toward the conference room, the hulking mass of Sims preceding them. The security guard grabbed the door and held it open, frowning at Lucas as he went by. Lucas shivered as he crossed the threshold. He could feel the sweat running down his chest, could feel guilty heat in his armpits and around his neck. He had a sudden image of being thrown against the table, pinned down, contraband yanked from his pockets and waved in his face.
Sit,
Bernard said. He put the box down on the table, and he and Sims began disgorging its contents while Lucas lowered himself into a chair.
Vacation chits,
Sims said, pulling out the stack of paper coupons. Lucas watched the way the man's arms rippled with muscle with even the slightest movement. Sims had been a tech once, until his body kept growing and made him too obviously suited for other, less cerebral endeavors. He lifted the chits to his nose, took a sniff, and recoiled.
Smells like sweaty greaser, he said.
Counterfeit? Bernard asked.
Sims shook his head. Bernard was inspecting the small wooden box. He shook it and rapped it with his knuckles, listening to the rattle of chits inside. He searched the exterior for a hinge or clasp. Lucas almost blurted out that the top slid, that it was so finely crafted you could barely see the joints, and that it took a bit of effort. Bernard muttered something and set the box aside.
"What exactly are we looking for?" Lucas asked.
He leaned forward and grabbed the box, pretended to be inspecting it for the first time.
"Anything. A fucking clue," Bernard barked.
He glared at Lucas.
How did this greaser make it over the hill? Was it something she did? One of my techs? What?
Lucas still couldn't figure the anger. So what if she hadn't cleaned? It would have been a double anyway. Was Bernard pissed because he didn't know why she'd survived so long? This made sense to Lucas. Whenever he fixed something by accident, it drove him nearly as nuts as having something break. And he'd seen Bernard angry before, but this was something different. The man was livid. He was manic. It's just how Lucas would feel if he'd had such an unprecedented piece of success with no cause to pin it on. Sims, meanwhile, found the notebook and began flipping through it.
Hey, boss.
Bernard snatched it from him and tore through the pages, reading.
Someone'll have to go through all of this, he said.
He pushed his glasses up his nose.
There might be some sign of collusion in here.
Hey, look, Lucas said, holding out the box. It opens. He showed them the sliding lid.
Let me see that.
Bernard dropped the notebook to the table and snatched the wooden box away. He wrinkled his nose.
Just chits,
he said disgustingly. He dumped them on the table and was about to toss the box aside, but Sims grabbed it from him.
That's an antique, the large man said. You think it's a clue, or can I...
Yes, keep it by all means.
Bernard waved his arms out toward the window with its view of the entrance hall.
Because nothing of greater fucking importance is going on around here, is it, shit for brains?
Sims shrugged noncommittally and slid the wooden box into his pocket. Lucas desperately wanted to be somewhere else, anywhere in the silo but there.
Maybe she just got lucky,
Sims offered. Bernard began dumping the rest of the box onto the table, shaking it to loosen the manual that Lucas knew was tightly wedged in the bottom. He paused from his efforts and squinted at Sims over the rims of his glasses.
Lucky?
Bernard repeated. Sims tilted his head.
Get the fuck out of here,
Bernard told him. Sims nodded.
Yeah, you're right.
No, I mean, get out!
Bernard pointed at the door.
Get the fuck out!
The head of security smiled like this was funny, but lumbered for the door. He slid out of the room and gently clicked the door shut behind him.
I'm surrounded by morons, Bernard said, once they were alone.
Lucas tried to imagine this was not meant as an insult directed at him.
Present company excluded,
Bernard added, as if reading his mind. Thanks.
Hey, at least you can fix a goddamn server. What the hell do I pay these other rat shit techs to do?
He pressed his glasses up the bridge of his nose again, and Lucas tried to remember if the IT head had always cursed this much. He didn't think so. Was it the strain of being interim mayor that was getting to him? Something had changed. It felt strange to even consider Bernard his friend anymore. The man was so much more important now, so much busier. Perhaps he was cracking under the stress that came with the extra responsibility. The pain of being the one to send good people to cleaning.
You know why I've never taken a shadow?
Bernard asked. He flipped through the manual, saw the play on the reverse side, and turned the bound sheets of paper around. He glanced up at Lucas, who lifted his palms and shrugged.
It's because I shudder to think of anyone else ever running this place.
Lucas assumed he meant IT, not the silo. Bernard hadn't been mayor very long. Bernard set the play down and gazed out the window where muffled voices argued once more.
But I'll have to, one of these days. I'm at that age where your friends, the people you grew up with, are dropping like flies, but you're still young enough to pretend it won't happen to you.
His eyes fell to Lucas. The young tech felt uncomfortable being alone with Bernard. He'd never felt that before.
Silos have burned to the ground before because of one man's hubris, Bernard told him. All it takes is improper planning, thinking you'll be around forever. But because one man disappears, he snapped his fingers, and leaves a sucking void behind, that can be enough to bring it all down.
Lucas was dying to ask his boss what the hell he was talking about.
Today is that day, I think.
Bernard walked around the long conference table, leaving behind him the scattered remnants of Juliet's life. Lucas's gaze drifted over the items. The guilt of going through them vanished to see how they'd been treated. He wished, instead, that he'd stashed away more of them.
What I need is someone who already has access to the servers, Bernard said.
Lucas turned to the side and realized the short, full-bellied head of IT was standing right beside him. He moved his hand up to his chest pocket, making sure it didn't bulge open where Bernard could see.
Sammy is a good tech. I trust him, but he's nearly as old as I am.
You aren't that old, Lucas said, trying to be polite, to gather his wits. He wasn't sure what was going on.
There's not many people I consider a friend,
Bernard said. I appreciate that.
You're probably the closest thing.
I feel the same.
I knew your father. He was a good man.
Lucas swallowed and nodded. He looked up at Bernard and realized the man was holding out his hand. Had been for a while. He reached out his own to accept, still not sure what was being offered.
I need a shadow, Lucas.
Bernard's hand felt small in Lucas's own. He watched as his arm was pumped up and down.
I want you to be that man.
8. Wisely and slow, they stumble that run fast. Juliet forced her way through the inner airlock door and scrambled to get it closed. Darkness overwhelmed her as the heavy door squealed on its hinges and settled against its dry seals. She groped for the large locking wheel and leaned on the spokes, spinning it and sealing the door tight. The air in her suit was growing stale. She could feel the dizziness overtaking her. Turning around, keeping one hand on the wall, she stumbled forward through the darkness. The puff of outside air that she'd allowed inside seemed to claw at her back like a horde of mad insects. Juliet staggered blindly down the hallway, trying to put distance between herself and the dead she'd left behind. There were no lights on, no glow from the wall screens with their view of the outside world. She'd prayed the layout was the same, that she could find her way. She prayed the air in her suit would hold out a moment longer, prayed the air in the silo wasn't as foul and toxic as the wind outside. Or, and just as bad, that the air in the silo wasn't as devoid of oxygen as what little remained in her suit. Her hand brushed the bars of a cell just where they should be, giving her hope that she could navigate the darkness. She wasn't sure what she'd hope to find in the pitch black. She had no plan for salvation. She was simply stumbling away from the horrors outside. It hardly registered for her that she had been there, had gone outside, and now was in someplace new. As she fumbled through the office, sucking on the last breaths of air in her helmet, her feet knocked into something, and Juliet went sprawling forward. She landed roughly on a soft mound, groped with her hand, and felt an arm. A body. Several bodies. Juliet crawled over them, the spongy flesh feeling more human and solid than the husks and bones outside, and more difficult to move across. She felt someone's chin. The weight of her body caused their neck to turn, and she nearly lost her balance. Her body recoiled at the sensation of what she was doing, the reflex to apologize, to pull her limbs away, but she forced herself forward over a pile of them, through the darkness, until her helmet slammed into the office door. The blow was hard enough and so without warning that Juliet saw stars and feared blacking out. She reached up and fumbled for the handle. Her eyes might as well have been sealed shut, the utter darkness was so complete. Even the bowels of mechanical had never seen such deep and perfect shadow. She found the latch and pushed. The door was unlocked but wouldn't budge. Juliet scrambled to her feet, her boots digging into lifeless bodies, and threw her shoulder against the door. She wanted out. The door moved, a little. She could feel something slide on the other side and imagined more bodies piled up. She threw herself again and again into the door, grunts of effort and frustrated tiny screams echoing in her helmet. Her hair was loose, sweaty, and matting to her face. She couldn't see, couldn't breathe, was growing more faint as she poisoned her own internal atmosphere. When the door slid open a crack, she tried to force her way through, one shoulder first, squeezing her helmet past, then pulling her other arm and leg after. She fell to the floor, scrambled around, and shoved herself against the door, sealing it tight. There was a dim light, almost impossible to notice at first. A barricade of tables and chairs were pressed in against her, scattered from her efforts to get through. Their hard edges and spindly legs seemed intent on ensnaring her. Juliet heard herself wheezing for air and knew her time had run out. She imagined the poison all over her like grease. The toxic air that she'd let in was a cloud of vermin, just waiting for her to crawl out of her shell so they could eat away at her. She considered lying down and letting her air supply run out instead. She would be preserved in this chrysalis of a suit, a well-built suit, a gift from Walker and the people of supply. Her body would lie forever in this dim silo that shouldn't exist, but so much better than to rot on a lifeless hill and fly away, piece by piece, on a fickle breeze. It would be a good death. She panted, proud of herself for making it somewhere of her own choosing, for conquering these last few obstacles. Slumping against the door, she very nearly laid down and closed her eyes, but for the nagging of her curiosity. Juliet held up her hands and studied them in the dim glow from the stairwell. The shiny gloves, wrapped in heat tape and melted to form a bright skin, made her look like a machine of sorts. She ran her hands over the dome of her helmet, realizing she was like a walking toaster. When she had been a mere shadow in mechanical, she'd had a bad habit of taking things apart, even those that already worked. What had Walker said of her? That she liked nothing more than peering inside of toasters. Juliet sat up and tried to focus. She was losing sensation, and with it, the will to live. She shook her head and pulled herself to her feet, sent a pile of chairs crashing to the floor. She was the toaster, she realized. Her curiosity wanted it open. This time, to see what was outside. To take one breath and know. She swam through the tables and chairs, wanting more and more distance between herself and any bad air she had let in. The bodies she had crawled over in the sheriff's office had felt whole, naturally dead, trapped inside and starved or asphyxiated, perhaps, but not rotten. Still, and despite her lightheadedness and need to breathe, she wanted to somehow douse herself before cracking the helmet. She escaped the barrier of tables and chairs and made her way across the open cafeteria floor. The emergency lights in the stairwell leaked a green glow to dimly show the way. She passed through the serving door and into the kitchen and tried the taps on a large sink. The handles turned, but the spout didn't leak a drop. Didn't knock with even a futile try from distant pumps. She went to the dangling hose over the dish station and pulled that lever, and was similarly rewarded. There was no water. Her next thought was the walk-ins, to maybe freeze the nastiness she could feel crawling all over her suit. She staggered around the cooking stations and pulled the large silver handle on the door, her breath wheezy in her helmet. The light in the back reaches of the kitchen was already so dim she could barely see. She couldn't feel any cold through her suit, but wasn't sure if she'd be able to. It was built to shield her, and built well. The overhead light didn't come on, so she assumed the freezer was dead. With the door open, she peered inside, looking for anything fluid, and saw what looked like vats of soup. She was desperate enough to try anything. Juliet moved inside the walk-in, letting the door swing slowly shut behind her. She seized one of the large plastic containers, a bucket the size of the largest cooking pots, and tore the top off. The door clicked shut, returning her to solid darkness. Juliet knelt beneath the shelf and tipped the massive bucket over. She could feel the liquid soup splatter all over her suit, crinkling it and splashing to the floor. Her knees slipped in the stuff. She felt for the next one and did the same, ran her fingers into the puddles and coated herself in it. There was no way of knowing if she was being crazy, if she was making things worse, or if any of it mattered. Her boot slipped, sending her flat on her back, her helmet cracking against the floor. Juliet lay there in a puddle of tepid soup, unable to see, her breath raspy and stale. Her time had run out. She was dizzy and could think of nothing else to try. Didn't have the breath or energy anyway. The helmet had to come off. She fumbled for the latches, could barely feel them through her gloves. Her gloves were too thick. They were going to kill her. She rolled to her belly and crawled through the soup, her hands and knees slipping. She reached the door, gasping, and fumbled for the handle, found it, threw the door open. There was a rack of knives gleaming behind the counter. She lurched to her feet and grabbed one, held the blade in her thick mitts, and slumped to the floor, exhausted and dizzy. Turning the blade toward her own neck, Juliet groped for the latch. She slid the point along her collar until it caught in the crack of the button. Steadying herself, her arm shaking, she moved the knife and pressed in, shoving it toward her body against all physical revulsion at the act. There was a faint click. Juliet gasped and groped along the rim with the blade for the other button until she found it. She repeated the maneuver. Another click, and her helmet popped off. Juliet's body took over for her, urging deep gulps of foul air. The stench was unbearable, but she couldn't stop gasping for more. Rotted food, biological decay, a tepid filth of stenches invaded her mouth, tongue, nose. She turned to the side and retched, but nothing came out. Her hands were still slippery with soup. Breathing was painful. She imagined a burning sensation on her skin, but it could have been her fevered state. She crawled away from the walk-in, toward the cafeteria, out of the fog of rotting soup, before she managed a gulp of air. Air. She took another lungful, the odor still overpowering, the soup coating her. But beyond the stench, something else was there. Something faint. Something breathable that began to force away the dizziness and the panic. It was oxygen. Life. Juliet was still alive. She laughed a mad laugh and stumbled toward the stairwell, drawn to the green glow of light, breathing deeply and too exhausted to appreciate this, the impossible life still in her. 9. For you and I are past our dancing days. Nock saw the uproar in mechanical as just another emergency to overcome. Like the time the basement subwall sprung a leak, or when the oil rig hit that pocket of methane and they had to evacuate 8 levels until the air handlers made it safe to return. Against the inevitable flow of commotion, what he needed to do was push for order, to assign tasks. He had to break a huge undertaking down to discrete bits and make sure they all fell to the right hands. Only this time, he and his people wouldn't be setting out to repair something. There were things the good people of mechanical meant to break.
"Supply is the key,"
he told his foreman, pointing to the large-scale blueprint hanging on the wall. He traced the stairwell up the 30 flights to supply's main manufacturing floor.
"Our greatest advantage is that IT doesn't know we're coming."
He turned to his shift leaders.
"Shirley, Mark, and Courtney, you'll come with me. We'll load up with supplies and take your shadows with us. Walker, you can wire ahead and let them know we're coming. Be discreet, though. Assume IT has ears. Say we have a load of your repairs to deliver."
He turned to Jenkins, who had shadowed under Knox for 6 years before he grew his own beard and moved to third shift. The assumption everywhere was that Knox's job was his in waiting.
"Jinx, I want you to take over down here. There are no days off for a while. Keep the place running, but get ready for the worst. I want as much food stockpiled as possible. And water. Make sure the cistern is topped up. Divert from the hydroponics feed if you have to, but be discreet. Think of an excuse, like a leak or something, in case they notice. Meanwhile, have someone make the rounds and check every lock and hinge, just in case the fighting comes to us. And stockpile whatever weapons you can make up, pipes, hammers, whatever."
Some eyebrows were lifted at this, but Jenkins nodded at the list as if it all made sense and was doable. Knox turned to his foreman.
"What? You know where this is heading, right?"
"But what's the larger picture?"
Courtney asked, glancing at the tall blueprint of their buried home.
"Storm IT, and then what? Take over running this place?"
"We already run this place," Knox growled.
He slapped his hand across the floors of the mid-30s.
We just do it in the dark. Like, these levels here are dark to us, but now I mean to shine a light in their rat hole and scare them out. See what else they're hiding.
You understand what they've been doing, right? Mark turned to Courtney. They've been sending people out to die. On purpose. Not because it had to happen, but because they wanted it to.
Courtney bit her lip and didn't say anything, just stared at the blueprint.
We need to get going, Knox said. Walker, get that wire out. Let's load up. And think of something pleasant to chat about while we're on the move. No grumbling about this where some porter can hear and make a chit or two ratting us out.
They nodded. Knox slapped Jenkins on the back and dipped his chin at the younger man.
I'll send word when we need everyone. Keep the bare bones you think you've got to have down here and send the rest. Timing is everything, okay?
I know what to do, Jenkins said.
He wasn't trying to be uppity, just reassuring his elder.
All right, Knox said. Then let's get to it.
They made it up 10 flights with little complaint, but Knox could begin to feel the burn in his legs from the heavy load. He had a canvas sack stuffed full of welding smocks on his wide shoulders, plus a bundle of helmets. A rope had been strung through their chin straps, and they clattered down his wide back. Mark struggled with his load of pipe stock as they kept trying to slide against one another and slip out of his arms. The shadows brought up the rear, behind the women, with heavy sacks of blasting powder tied together so they hung around their necks. Professional porters with similarly full loads breezed past them in both directions, their glances signaling a mix of curiosity and competitive anger. When one porter, a woman Knox recognized from deliveries to the down deep, stopped and offered to help, he gruffly sent her on her way. She hurried up the steps, looking back over her shoulder before spiraling out of view, and Knox regretted taking his exhaustion out on her.
Keep it up, he told the others.
Even with the small group, they were making a spectacle, and it was growing ever more tiresome to hold their tongues as news of Juliet's amazing disappearance gyred all around them. At almost every landing, a group of people, often younger people, stood around and gossiped about what it all meant. The taboo had moved from thought to whisper. Forbidden notions were birthed on tongues and swam through the air. Knox ignored the pain in his back and lumbered up and up, each step driving them closer to supply, feeling more and more like they needed to get there in a hurry. As they left the 130s, the grumblings were fully in the air. They were nearing the upper half of the down deep, where people who worked, shopped, and ate in the mids mingled with those who would rather they didn't. Deputy Hank was on the stairwell of 128, trying to mediate between two arguing crowds. Knox squeezed past, hoping the officer wouldn't turn and see his heavily loaded train and ask them what they were doing up this far. As he ascended past the ruckus, Knox glanced back to watch the shadows slink past, hugging the inner rail. Deputy Hank was still asking a woman to please calm down as the landing sank out of sight. They passed the dirt farm on 126, and Knox figured this to be a key asset. The 30s of IT were a long hike up, but if they had to fall back, they would need to hold at supply. Between their manufacturing, the food on this level, and the machinery of mechanical, they might be self-sufficient. He could think of a few weak links, but many more for IT. They could always shut off their power or stop treating their water, but he really hoped, as they approached supply on weary legs, that it wouldn't come to any of that. They were greeted on the landing of 110 by frowns. McLean, the elder woman and head of supply, stood with her arms crossed over her yellow coveralls, her effect screaming unwelcome.
Hello, Jove.
Knox fixed her with a wide smile.
Don't Jove me, McLean said. What's this nonsense you're after?
Knox glanced up and down the stairwell, shrugged his heavy load higher up on his shoulder.
Mind if we step in and talk about it?
I don't want any trouble here, she said,
her eyes blazing beneath her lowered brow.
"Let's go inside," Knox said. "We haven't stopped once on the way up, unless you want us collapsing out here."
McLean seemed to consider this. Her arms loosened across her chest. She turned to three of her workers, who formed an imposing wall behind her, and nodded. While they pulled open the gleaming doors of supply, she turned and grabbed Knox's arm.
"Don't get comfortable," she told him.
Inside the front room of supply, Knox found a small army of men and women in their yellow coveralls, waiting. Most of them stood behind the low, long counter where the people of the silo normally waited for whatever parts they needed, whether newly fabricated or recently repaired. The parallel and deep aisles of shelves beyond ran into the gloomy distance, boxes and bins bulging off of them. The room was noticeably quiet. Usually the mechanical thrumming and clanking sounds of fabrication could be heard worming their way through the space, or one might hear workers chatting unseen back in the stacks while they sorted newly fashioned bolts and nuts into hungry bins. Now it was just silence and distrustful glares. Knox stood with his people, their sacks and loads slumping exhaustedly to the floor, sweat on their brows, while the men and women of supply watched, unmoving. He had expected a more amicable welcome. Mechanical and supply had a long history together. They jointly ran the small mine beneath the lowest levels of mechanical that supplemented the silo's stockpile of ores. But now, as McLean followed her boys back inside, she graced Knox with a look of scorn he hadn't seen since his mother passed away.
"What in the hell is the meaning of this?" she hissed at Knox.
He was taken aback by the language, especially in front of his people. He thought of himself and McLean as equals, but now he was being snapped at as if by one of Supply's dogs. McLean ranged down the exhausted line of mechanics and their shadows before turning back to him.
"Before we discuss how we're cleaning this problem up, I want to hear how you're handling your employees, whoever was responsible."
Her eyes bore through him.
"I am correct in assuming you had nothing to do with this, right? That you've come to apologize and shower me with bribes?"
Shirley started to say something, but Knox waved her off. There were a lot of people in the room, just waiting for this to go undiplomatically.
"Yes, I do apologize," Knox said, grinding his teeth together and bowing his head. "And no, I just learned of this earlier today, after I found out about the cleaning, in fact."
"So it was all your electrician?" McLean said, her thin arms crossed tightly over her chest.
"One man." "That's right, but..."
"I've meted out punishments to those involved here, let me tell you, and I suppose you'll have to do more than banish that old fart to his room."
There was laughter behind the counter. Knox put a hand on Shirley's shoulder to keep her in place. He looked past McLean to the men and women arranged behind McLean.
"They came and took one of our workers," he said.
His chest may have been heavy, but his voice still boomed.
"You know how it happens. When they want a body for cleaning, they take it."
He thumped his chest.
"And I let them. I stood there because I trust this system. I fear it, just as any of you."
"Well,"
McLean began, but Knox continued in that voice that routinely gave calm commands over the racket of machines run amok.
"One of my people was taken, and it was the oldest of us, the wisest of us, who intervened on her behalf. It was the weakest and most scared of us who braved his neck. And whoever of you he turned to for help, and who gave it, I owe you my life."
Knox blinked away the blur and continued.
"You gave her more than a chance to walk over that hill, to die in peace and out of sight. You gave me the courage to open my eyes, to see this veil of lies we live behind."
"That's quite enough," McLean barked. "Someone could be sent to cleaning for even listening to such nonsense, to such drivel."
"It's not nonsense," Mark cried down the line. "Juliet is dead because of..."
"She's dead because she broke these very laws," McLean snapped, her voice high and shrill.
And now you march up here to break even more on my level?
We aim to break heads, Shirley said.
Leave it,
Knox told them both. He saw the anger in McLean's eyes, but he also saw something else. The sporadic nods and raised brows among the rank and file behind her. A porter entered the room with empty sacks in each hand and looked around at the tense silence. One of the large supply workers by the door ushered him back onto the landing with apologies, telling him to return later. Knox composed his words carefully during the interruption.
No person has ever been sent to cleaning for listening, however great the taboo.
He allowed that to sink in. He glared at McLean as she moved to interrupt, but she seemed to decide against it.
So let me be sent to cleaning by any of you for what I'm about to say. I will welcome it if these facts do not move you to instead push forward with me and my men. For this is what Walker and a few of you brave souls have shown us this morning. We have cause for more hope than they'll dare give us. There's more at our disposal to broaden our horizons than they'll allow. We have been raised on a pack of lies, made to fear by the sight of our kinsmen rotting on the hills. But now, one of us has crossed over that. They have seen new horizons. We have been given seals and washers and told that they should suffice, but what are they?
He stared down the men and women behind the counter. McLean's arm seemed to loosen across her chest.
Designed to fail, that's what. Fake. And who knows what other lies there are. What if we'd taken any cleaner back and done our best by them? Cleaned and disinfected them. Tried whatever we could. Would they survive? We can no longer trust IT to tell us they wouldn't.
Knox saw chins rise and fall. He knew his own people were ready to storm the room if need be. They were as amped up and driven mad by all this as he was.
We are not here to cause trouble, he said. We are here to bring order. The uprising has already happened.
He turned to McLean.
Don't you see? We have been living the uprising. Our parents were the children of it, and now we feed our own children to the same machine. This will not be the start of something new, but the end of something old. And if supply is with us, we stand a chance. If not, then may our bodies haunt your view of the outside, which I now see as far less rotten than this blasted silo.
Knox bellowed this last in open defiance of all taboo. He threw it out and savored the taste of it. The admission that anything beyond those curved walls might be better than what's inside them. The whisper that had killed so many became a throaty roar, shouted from his broad chest. And it felt good. McLean cringed. She took a step away, something like fear in her eyes. She turned her back on Knox and made to return to her people, and he knew he had failed. That there had been a chance, however slim, in this silent and still crowd to inspire action. But the moment had slipped him by, or he had scared it off. And then McLean did something. Knox could see the tendons in her slender neck bulge. She lifted her chin to her people, her white hair in its tight knot high on her head, and she said quietly,
"What say you, Supply?"
It was a question, not a command. Knox would later wonder if it had been asked in sadness. He would wonder if she had taken poor stock of her people, who had listened patiently during his madness. He would also wonder if she were just curious, or if she were challenging them to cast him and his mechanics out. He would finally wonder,
tears streaming down his face, thoughts of Juliet swelling inside his heart. If he could even hear his handful of compatriots shouting, so drowned out were they by the angry war cries of the good men and women of Supply. 10. And too soon marred are those so early made. The earth hath swallowed all my hopes but she. Lucas followed Bernard through the halls of IT, nervous techs scattering before them like nightbugs startled by the light. Bernard didn't seem to notice the techs ducking into offices and peering through windows. Lucas hurried to keep up, his eyes darting side to side, feeling conspicuous with all these hidden others watching. "Aren't I a little old to be shadowing for another job?" he asked. He was pretty sure he hadn't accepted the offer, not verbally, anyway, but Bernard spoke as if the deal were done.
"Nonsense," he said, "and this won't be shadowing in the traditional sense."
He waved his hand in the air.
"You'll continue your duties as before. I just need someone who can step in, who knows what to do in case something happens to me. My will..."
He stopped at the heavy door to the server room and turned to face Lucas.
"If it came to it, in an emergency, my will would explain everything to the next head, but..."
He gazed over Lucas's shoulder and down the hall.
"Sims is my executor, which will have to change. I just don't see that ever going smoothly."
Bernard rubbed his chin and lost himself in his thoughts. Lucas waited a moment, then stepped beside him and entered his code on the panel by the door, fished his ID out of his pocket, made sure it was his ID and not Juliet's, and swiped it through the reader. The door clicked open, snapping Bernard out of his thoughts.
"Yes, well, this will be much better. Not that I expect to go anywhere, mind you."
He adjusted his glasses and stepped through the heavy steel doorway. Lucas followed, pushing the monstrous enclosure shut behind them and waiting for the locks to engage.
"But if something did happen to you, I would oversee the cleanings?"
Lucas couldn't imagine. He suspected there was more to learn about those suits than the servers. Sammy would be better at this, would actually want this job. Also, would he have to abandon his star charts?
"That's a small part of the job, but yes."
Bernard guided Lucas through the servers, past number 13 with its blank face and still fans, all the way to the back of the room.
"These are the keys to the true heart of the silo," Bernard said, fishing a jangling set out of his coveralls.
They were strung on a cord of leather that hung around his neck. Lucas had never noticed them before.
"There are other features to this cabinet that you'll learn about in time. For now, you simply need to know how to get downstairs."
He inserted the key into several locks on the back of the server, locks designed to look like recessed screws. What server was this, 28? Lucas glanced around the room and tried to count its position, and realized he'd never been assigned to maintain this tower. There was a gentle clang as the back came off. Bernard set it aside, and Lucas saw why he'd never worked on the machine. It was practically empty. Just a shell, like it had been scrapped for parts over the long years.
"It's crucial that you lock this after coming back up."
Lucas watched Bernard grab a handle in the bottom of the empty chassis. He pulled up, and there was a soft grinding noise nearby.
"When the grate's back in place, you simply press this down to secure it."
He was about to ask, "What grate?" when Bernard stepped aside and dug his fingers into the metal slats of the floor. With a grunt, he pulled the heavy surface of the flooring up and began sliding it over. Lucas jumped around to the other side and bent down to help.
"Wouldn't the stairs..." he started to ask.
They don't access this part of 35.
Bernard waved at a ladder leading down through the floor.
You go first.
Lucas's head spun from the day's sudden turn. As he bent to grab the ladder, he felt the contents of his breast pocket shift and shot a hand up to hold the watch, ring, and ID steady. What had he been thinking? What was he thinking now? He lowered himself down the long ladder, feeling like someone had initiated an automated routine in his brain, a rote program that had taken over his actions. From the bottom of the ladder, he watched as Bernard lowered himself down the first rungs before sliding the grate into place, sealing them both inside the dark dungeon beneath the already fortressed server room.
You are about to receive a great gift, Bernard said in the darkness, just as I was once granted the same.
He flicked on a light, and Lucas saw that his boss was grinning maniacally, the anger from before gone. Here was a new man before him, a confident and eager man.
All the silo and everyone in it hinges on what I'm about to show you, Bernard said.
He waved Lucas down the brightly lit but tight corridor and toward a wider room beyond. The servers felt very far above. They felt closed off from every other soul in the silo. Lucas was curious, but also afraid. He wasn't sure he wanted such responsibility and cursed himself for going along with this. And yet, his feet moved. They carried him down that hidden passageway and into a room full of the strange and curious, a place that made the charting of stars seem insignificant, a den where the sense of the world's scale, of size, took on wholly new proportions. 11. I'll bury thee in a triumphant grave. A grave? Oh, no! A lantern, slaughtered youth, for here lies Juliet, and her beauty makes this vault a feasting presence full of light. Juliet left her soup-slathered helmet on the floor and moved toward the pale green glow of light. It seemed brighter than before. She wondered how much of the darkness had been her helmet. As her senses returned, she remembered that it wasn't a piece of glass she'd been looking through, but some infernal screen that took the world as she saw it and overlaid it with half a lie. Maybe it had dimmed her view in the process. She noticed the stench from her drenched suit followed her, the smell of rotten vegetables and mold, or possibly the toxic fumes from the outside world. Her throat burned a little as she crossed the cafeteria toward the stairwell. Her skin began to itch, and she couldn't tell if it was from fear, from her imagination, or truly something in the air. She didn't dare risk finding out, so she held her breath and hurried, as fast as her weary legs would take her, around the corner to where she knew the stairs would be. "This world is the same as my world," she thought to herself, stumbling down the first flight of stairs in the wan glow of emergency light strips. The gods built more than one. Her heavy boots, still dripping with soup, felt unsteady on the metal treads. At the landing on 2, she paused and took in a few gulps of air, less painful gulps, and considered how best to remove the infernal and bulky outfit that made every moment awkward, that reeked of the fetid smell of rot and outside air. She looked down at her arms. The thing had required help to don. There were double zippers in the back, layers of Velcro, miles of heat tape. She looked at the knife in her hand, suddenly grateful that she had never dropped it after using it to remove her helmet. Gripping the knife with one clumsy glove, she carefully inserted the tip through the other sleeve, right above the top of her wrist. She forced the point through, pushing the blade over the top of her arm so it wouldn't jab her, even if it pierced all the way. The fabric was difficult to cut, but a tear finally formed as she augured the handle in small circles. She slid the knife into this tiny rip, the dull side of the blade facing her skin, and slid it down her arm and toward her knuckles. When the tip of the blade ripped through the fabric between her fingers, she was able to free her hand from the long gash she'd made, the sleeve flopping from her elbow. Juliet sat down on the grating, moved the knife to her newly freed hand, and worked on the other side. She freed it as well while soup dripped from her shoulders and down her arms. She next started a tear at her chest, managing better control of the knife now without the thick gloves on. She ripped the metal foil exterior away, peeling herself like an orange. The solid collar for her helmet had to stay. It was attached to her charcoal fabric undersuit as well as the reinforced zippers up her back, but piece by piece she removed the shiny outer coat, which was slathered with a nastiness she attributed partly to the soup and partly to her trek over the hills. Next came her boots, which were cut free around the ankles until she was able to work them off, sawing a slit down the outside edge and popping one foot free, then the other. Before she cleaned up the hanging tatters of fabric any further, or worried about the material still attached to the zipper at her back, she got up from the landing and hurried down the steps, putting more distance between herself and the air above that seemed to scratch at her throat. She was another two flights down, swimming through the green glow of the stairwell, before she appreciated the fact that she was alive. She was alive. For however much longer, this was a brutal, beautiful, and brand new fact for Juliet. She had spent 3 days climbing long stairs similar to these as she came to grips with her fate. Another day and night had been spent in a cell made for the future corpses who dotted the landscape. And then, this. An impossible trek through the wilderness of the forbidden, breaking in to the impenetrable and the unknown, surviving. Whatever happened next, for this moment, Juliet flew down foreign steps in bare feet, the steel cool against her tingling skin, the air burning her throat less and less with each gulp of new air, the raw stench and memory of death receding further and further above her. Soon, it was just the patter of her joyous descent ringing out and drifting down a lonely and empty darkness, like a muffled bell that rang not for the dead, but for the living. She stopped on 6 and rested while she worked on what remained of her protective suit. With care, she sliced her black undersuit by her shoulders and collarbone, working the tear all the way around and clawing at her back as it ripped free, strips of heat tape still attached. Once the helmet collar was detached from the fabric, just the zipper hanging like a second spine along her back, she could finally remove it from her neck. She pulled it off and dropped it to the ground, then stripped off the rest of the black carbon fabric, peeling away the arms and legs and leaving all the material in a rough pile outside the double doors to level 6. 6 should be an apartment level, she thought. She considered going inside and yelling out for help or looking for clothes and supplies in the many rooms, but her greater impulse was to descend. The uptop felt poisoned and too close. It didn't matter if it was all in her imagination or if it was from her miserable experiences living in the uptop of her own silo. Her body felt a revulsion for the place. Safe was the down deep. It had always felt this way. One hopeful image did linger from the upper kitchen. The rows and rows of canned and jarred food for the lean harvests. Juliet figured there would be more in the lower mess halls as well. And the air in the silo seemed decent as she regained her breath. The sting in her lungs and on her tongue had faded. Either the vast silo held a lot of air that was now being consumed by no one, or There was still a source. All these thoughts gave her hope, these tallies of resources. So she left her spoiled and tattered clothing behind, and armed with only a large chef's knife, she stole down the curved stairs naked, her body becoming more and more alive with every step taken, her mind becoming more determined to keep the rest of her that way. On 13, she stopped and checked inside the doors. There was always the chance that this silo was laid out completely differently, floor to floor, so it made little sense to plan ahead if she didn't know what to expect. There were only a handful of areas in the uptop that she was intimately familiar with, and every bit of overlap so far had seemed a perfect copy. 13, she would definitely know. There were certain things, learned so young and remembered so deep, that they felt like little stones in the center of her mind. These would be the parts of her that rotted last, the bits left over once the rest skittered off on the wind or was drunk deep by the roots. In her mind, as she pushed the door open a crack, she wasn't in a different silo, an abandoned husk of a silo, but in her past, pushing open a door on her youth. It was dark inside. None of the security or emergency lights on. There was a different smell. The air was stagnant and had a tinge of decay. Juliet shouted down the hallway, "Hello?" She listened to her voice echo back from the empty walls. The voice that returned sounded distant, weaker, higher than her own. She imagined herself at age 9, running through these very halls, crying out to her older self across the years. She tried to picture her mother chasing behind that girl, attempting to scoop her up and force her to be still. But the ghosts evaporated in the darkness. The last of the echoes faded, leaving her alone and naked in the doorway. As her eyes adjusted, she could just barely make out a reception desk at the end of the hall. Light reflected off glass windows just where they should be. It was the exact same layout as her father's nursery in the Mids, the place where she had been not just born, but raised. It was hard to believe that this was someplace different, that other people had lived here, other children had been born, had played, and had been raised just over a hill and down a dip, had given chase or challenged each other to hop or whatever games they had invented, all of them unaware of the other. Maybe it was from standing in the doorway of a nursery, but she couldn't help but think of all the lives this place had contained. People growing up, falling in love, burying their dead. All those people outside. People she had desecrated with her boots, scattering their bones and ashes as she kicked her way into the very place they had fled. Juliet wondered how long ago it had happened, how long since the silo had been abandoned. What had happened here? The stairwell was still lit, which meant the battery room still held juice. She needed paper to do the math, to figure how recently or how long ago all this life had turned to death. There were practical reasons for wanting to know, beyond the mere itch of curiosity. With one last look inside, one final shudder of regret for not stopping to see her father the last few times she'd passed his nursery, Juliet shut the door on the darkness and the ghosts and considered her predicament. She could very well be perfectly alone in a dying silo. The thrill of being alive at all was quickly draining away, replaced with the reality of her solitude and the tenuousness of her survival. Her stomach grumbled its agreement. She could somehow still smell the fetid soup on her, could taste the stomach acid from her retching. She needed water. She needed clothes. These primal urges were pushed to the forefront, drowning out the severity of her situation, the daunting tasks before her, leaving the regrets of the past behind. If the layout was the same, the first hydroponic farm would be 4 floors down. The larger of the 2 upper dirt farms would lie just below that. Juliet shivered from an updraft of cold air. The stairwell was creating its own thermal cycle, and it would only be colder the further down she went. But she went anyway. Lower was better. At the next level, she tried the door. It was too dark to see past the first interior hallway, but it seemed like offices or workrooms. She tried to remember what would be on the 14th in her own silo, but didn't know. Was it incredible to not know? The uptop of her own home had somehow been strange to her. That made this silo something completely alien. She held the door to 14 open and stuck the blade of her knife between the slits of metal that formed every landing's grating. The handle was left sticking up to form a stop. She allowed the door to close on its sprung hinges until it rested on the handle, holding it open. This let in enough light for her to steal inside and grope around the first handful of rooms. There were no coveralls hanging on the backs of the doors, but one room was set up for conferences. The water in the pitchers had long evaporated out, but the purple tablecloth looked warm enough. Warmer than being naked. Juliet moved the assortment of cups, plates, and pitchers and grabbed the cloth. She wrapped it around her shoulders, but it was going to slip off when she moved, so she tried knotting the corners in front of her. Giving up on this, she ran back to the landing, out into the welcomed light, and removed the fabric completely. Grabbing the knife, the door squealing eerily shut behind her, she pushed the blade through the center of the tablecloth and cut a long gash. Her head went through this, the cloth falling past her feet in front and behind her. A few minutes with the blade and she'd cut away the excess, forming a belt out of a long strip and, from another shock of fabric, enough to tie over her head and keep it warm. It felt good to be making something, to be engineering her way through one particular problem. She had a tool, a weapon, if need be, and clothes. The impossible list of tasks had been whittled down a few shavings. She descended further, her feet cold on the stairs, dreaming of boots, thirsty for water, very much aware of all that remained for her to do. On 15, she was reminded of another necessity as her weary legs nearly gave way. Her knees buckled. She grabbed the railing and she realized, as the adrenaline evaporated from her veins, that she was deathly tired. She paused on the landing, hands on her knees, and took a few deep breaths. How long had she been going? How much further could she push herself? She checked her reflection in the blade of the knife, saw how horrible she looked, and decided she needed rest before she went any further. Rest now, while it was still warm enough to not shiver to pieces. It was tempting to explore that level for a bed, but she decided against it. There would be little comfort in the pitch black behind those doors. So she curled up on the steel grating of Landing 15, tucked her arms under her head, and adjusted the tablecloth so every patch of bare skin was covered. And before she could go over the long list forming in her head, exhaustion took over. She drifted off to sleep with only a moment's panic that she shouldn't be so tired, that this might be the sort of nap one never woke up from, that she was destined to join the residents of this strange place, curled up and unmoving, frozen and lifeless, rotting and wasting away. 12. But old folks, many feign as they were dead, unwieldy, slow, heavy and pale as lead.
Do you understand what you're proposing we do?
Knox looked up at McLean, met her wrinkled and wizened eyes with as much confidence as he could muster. The tiny woman who controlled all the silo's spares and fabrication cast an oddly imposing figure. She didn't have Knox's barrel chest or thick beard, had wrists barely bigger than two of his fingers, but she possessed a wizened gray gaze and the weight of hard years that made him feel but a shadow in her presence.
"It's not an uprising," he said,
the forbidden words moving easily with the grease of habit and time.
"We're setting things to right."
McLean sniffed.
"I'm sure that's what my great-grandparents said,"
She pushed back loose strands of silver hair and peered down at the blueprint spread out between them. It was as if she knew this was wrong, but had resigned herself to helping rather than hinder it. Maybe it was her age, Knox thought, peering at her pink scalp through hair so thin and white as to be like filaments of glass. Perhaps with enough time in these walls, one could become resigned to things never getting better, or even changing all that much. Or maybe a person eventually lost hope that there was anything worth preserving at all. He looked down at the blueprint and smoothed the sharp creases in the fine paper. He was suddenly aware of his hands, how thick and grease-limbed his fingers appeared. He wondered if McLean saw him as a brute, storming up here with delusions of justice. She was old enough to see him as young, he realized. Young and hot-tempered, while he thought of himself as being old and wise. One of the dozens of dogs that lived among Supply's stacks grunted discontentedly under the table as if all this war planning were spoiling its nap.
I think it's safe to assume IT knows something is coming, McLean said, running her small hands across the many floors between them and 34.
Why? You don't think we were discreet coming up?
She smiled up at him.
I'm sure you were, but it's safe to assume this because it would be dangerous to assume otherwise.
He nodded and chewed on the part of his beard below his lower lip.
How long will the rest of your mechanics take to get here?